Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is absolutely the case that we're going to get hit with something probably a lot even scarier than COVID-19. Our ability to respond to those things effectively and quickly is so much better than it was 5 years ago. I mean, so it's an arms race. And we might be winning the arms race right now.
Malcolm Gladwell is a journalist, a public speaker, a podcast host, co-founder of a podcast company, and a New York Times bestselling author. Gladwell has been on the Time 100 Most Influential People list and is touted as one of foreign policy's top global thinkers. Stephen Colbert once said that Malcolm says things that other people haven't thought of before. And I'm very delighted to have him here in my Bedford, New York home and on my podcast. Welcome, Malcolm.
Thank you.
It's very nice to see you in person.
Yes.
I think I have seen you speak before in person, but we never met in person before.
Yes, this is our first.
So it's very exciting, and it's really a joy to talk to someone who has managed to take thoughts and put them into absolutely clear writing. I mean, I'm always amazed that you can take the word blink and make it into a book that really is meaningful or the tipping point. But first I wanted to talk. I had no idea, and I bet our audience doesn't have any idea, that you love cars.
I do.
Tell me why you love cars.
Well, I've always, you know how every four-year-old boy is obsessed with cars
and trucks and tractors.
I just never grew out of that phase. So it's just arrested development. There's nothing more than that. When I was a kid, when I was 13 years old, I rode away to every car company in the world, with the exception of one.
Which one?
The Russian Zil, which was I didn't know how to get in contact with them. But I collected, and I still have to this day, the promotional brochures on every single car made.
Like those big fancy books that they put out every year?
I think 1975, I have one for every car in the world.
How amazing.
Yeah, they're incredible time cap. Because, you know, back then, more so than now, incredible amount of thought and care went into the making of these promotional brochures. They were beautiful.
Oh, yeah. The photography is so extraordinary.
It was extraordinary.
And the way they set it up, and they took them onto mountains and deserts and all over the world, right?
The most fun ones were the General Motors ads back then always had, they took great pains to put, to pair a couple with the car. So they would imagine what the ideal couple was for this particular model of car. And they would give you, you know, it was a hilarious. I mean, I was a little kid, so I was kind of discovering the world of marketing, I guess. People, it was very rare for a car. I can't believe we're talking. This is so lovely. It's very rare for car ads back then to have people in them. It was an America. It was a very much a Detroit thing, but you wouldn't. The Germans, you if you looked at a Mercedes brochure from the mid-70s.
Only the engineering, right?
Yeah, it was a discussion of the engineering. It was a very technical picture of the car's kind of inner workings. And it was the car in motion on some Bavarian pass. But there were no people. I mean, that was not, they weren't thinking about people in their marketing.
And so what do you collect? You collect cars too?
Well, to say I collect them is too much. I have a Pride and Joy, which is a 2004 BMW M5. Which is considered the great.
I have no idea what he's talking about.
It is the great analog. It's the last great car they made before cars were taken over by computers.
Is it the little one? Was it little?
No. This is a sedan, a four-door sedan.
Okay. I must have had that car.
You probably did. If you had a BMW in the
I did.
In the early 2000s, this is the car.
This
is the car you would have had.
I gave it to my nephew because I didn't, you know, I didn't like the air conditioning or the heating. Something was
wrong
with that.
You're breaking my heart. You gave it away.
I gave it to my nephew. He needed a car.
Oh, I see. All right.
He was at Yale.
Yeah, I have, but I have, you know, I have these friends. I have several friends, one friend in particular, Dan, who has a garage full of the most beautiful cars imaginable.
Guess who I live next door to here? Do you know who?
No.
Ralph Lauren.
Oh, of course. Who's got an amazing.
Right next door.
Are you serious?
Yes. You want to go see his car collection?
He's got one of the great car collections
in the world.
In the world?
Yes.
Oh, yep. I would kill to see that. That's amazing.
I will arrange that for you.
Oh, that'd be fantastic.
Okay. Any other thing you want to say about cars?
No. Well, if you would like, I could talk about them forever, but we may want to talk about other things.
I think we should probably talk about who is Malcolm Gladwell and what has he done to create a great big buzz in the world of thinking. Really, this is all about thinking. It's for me, it is like just incredible. And your latest book, The Bomber Mafia, tell us about that. Is that your seventh book or eighth book?
I can't remember. It's sixth or seventh.
Okay.
It grew out of I went to Tokyo.
How many years ago?
This is 3 or 4 years ago. And first of all, I mean, I'm sure you've been to Tokyo many times. The most extraordinary city. I mean, I just fell in love with it right away.
Where'd you stay? It matters where you stay.
Well, I stayed in this little out-of-the-way place, but I spent one night in the Aman just to treat myself. And
good.
It was, I mean, it's fantastic.
But the Hyatt, did you go up to the top of the Hyatt?
No, I didn't. I've never done that.
See, I used to stay only at the Okra, which was the traditional Frank Lloyd Wright-ish kind of horizontal hotel.
Is that the one they tore
knocked
down?
They knocked down. Yeah. And then the most fabulous place. And only tatami rooms. You didn't sleep on a Western bed. You slept only on the futons.
Yeah.
So, but then I stayed at the Hyatt, which went up. I can't remember how many stories short compared to what they're building now in Singapore and elsewhere. But what an amazing place!
A friend of mine has a theory about Japan, which I love, which is the smaller things get in Japan, the better they are. So you as opposed to normally when you appreciate a new place, you expand your horizons, you look up, you kind of look. He said, no. In Japan, you narrow your gaze because their genius is all in the details.
Every detail.
If you look at Tokyo from afar, you don't understand. It looks like any Western
looks like
city.
Newark.
Yeah.
It's nothing. But it's nothing like Newark.
So my favorite Tokyo story was I was walking down a street and I saw a little tiny sign which said in English, coffee. It's a residential street. There's no other sign, no evidence whatsoever of this coffee shop, but I actually wanted a cup of coffee. So I spent 20 minutes hunting for this coffee shop because it was clear that it was somewhere. Ended up, you know, downstairs through an alley, upstairs, across a courtyard, up, you know, down a long corridor. And there is an absolutely exquisite room the size of this one with one person in it, a young woman. It's gorgeous. It's like, you know, a minimalist white with a beautiful window over a garden. And she made me the greatest cup of coffee I ever had in my life. And when I tried to tip her, you know, I'm an American. She got very offended, and I sort of felt like I had
transgressed. How much was a cup of coffee, do you remember?
I mean, it was, I can't remember.
A couple yen.
Yes, it was a couple yen. But it was such a Japanese experience. It's like they had this exquisite coffee house hidden away. You have to spend 20 minutes looking for it. And when you find it, it's this little jewel box.
Oh, no, I've been to Japan many times. It's actually one of my very favorite countries to visit. Yeah. As people are flocking to Italy, and I have nothing against Italy. I love Italy. I would rather go to Japan and discover that coffee shop. Yeah. And the little sushi restaurant hidden away someplace, or the oldest tree on Yakushima Island. I mean, that's what I go for.
Yeah.
It's an amazingly beautiful country.
Oh,
so you were visiting there. What happened?
I happened to go to this little museum, a private museum, in what looked like a dentist's office, in some distant corner of East Tokyo. And it was a museum dedicated to, it's called the Center for the Bombing of Tokyo or something. And it was the most homespun DIY museum you've ever seen. You know, things on printouts, computer printouts and photocopied things and scale models of things. And it was a record of the night that the U.S. Air Force firebombed Tokyo in March of 1945. It may be the day where more people died in a wartime action than any single day in history, certainly in the Second World War. 100,000 people, as many as 100,000 people were killed in this, with B-29s dropping napalm. They napalmed Tokyo in the spring of 1945.
And when was the bomb dropped on Hiroshima?
In the fall of 45.
Yeah,
so this is right before the dropping of the two nuclear bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima was the consequence of the failure of the firebombing campaign of the summer of 1945 to force Japan to surrender. They wouldn't surrender. So I went to this place and I knew nothing about this history, and I found the experience of going to the museum so moving that I thought I would love to tell the story of that night. And of course, the story of that night, the minute you commit yourself to telling the story of one night in a war, then you get pulled in a million different directions.
Of course.
And the Bomber Mafia is the kind of, I worked backwards from that night and told you, basically tried to tell the story of how was it that America decided to burn some huge portion of Tokyo to the ground with napalm in the spring of 45. What led us to that moment?
The most torturous, awfulest kind of thing to do, right?
Yeah, it is probably the darkest moment for the United States of the Second World War. It may have been, there's an argument that I make in the book, not that I'm endorsed, but the book is not intended to be a kind of, it's not my theory on the war. It's very descriptive. I'm trying to describe a struggle between two men, Curtis LeMay and a guy named Haywood Hansel, who had two radically different ideas about how to pursue the war against Japan. And they were polar opposites, and they hated each other. And
oh, they did?
Oh, it was.
And they're both Americans?
Both Americans.
And are they both generals?
Both generals.
Yeah.
And Haywood Hansel is in charge of the air war against Japan. And he tries it his way and fails.
And that was the atom bombs?
That was, no. He had a whole idea that you didn't, he believed in precision bombing. He had this notion, you can bring your enemy to his knees just by selectively bombing very critical industries, you know, aqueducts, power stations. You don't have to kill any civilians. You don't have to destroy a city.
That was sort of a nice way to bomb
it was the things. Yes, it's, yeah, the
more he tried humane way,
the most humane, right, way, and it doesn't work, and he's at wit's end, and he gets fired, and they bring in his antithesis, this man named Curtis LeMay, and LeMay is the man who says if the humane way doesn't work, I'm going to napalm Tokyo and burn it to the ground, and that's, the book is about that story, but of their conflict,
and also about the use of airplanes in war.
Yeah, it gets. Because you quickly, once you start from the premise, you know, it begins in Alabama because a group of these visionaries in the Air Force moved to Montgomery, Alabama in the mid-1930s because they want to be as far away as possible from Washington, D.C. And they sit at Maxwell Air Force Base. Have you ever been to Montgomery, by the way?
I have been to Montgomery, but I haven't been to the Air Force Base.
Ah, you must go to Maxwell.
Oh, actually,
this is a digression, but, you know, this is how much you should go to Maxwell. Because what it is, it is, first of all, a time capsule of 1940, of early, of the Southern. It is French colonial villas.
Wow.
For all of the officers. So these, imagine these huge oaks, those Southern.
Live oaks.
Live oaks.
They're so beautiful.
So we've got curving streets with these 100-year-old live oaks and these French colonial villas, which are for the officers. And it goes on for miles. It's like street after street after street of these, you know, exactly as they were in 1936 when they were built. And then you have these 40s kind of modernist buildings where all the Air Force offices are. It's just like you think you've been dropped into 1940. It's like you could film a movie there and you wouldn't change a single thing.
How great, because, you know, you go to other places, like in San Francisco, there's like an army base that looks like that too. Not Southern, but more like San Francisco architecture. They used to take the idiom of the local architecture and build the dormitories.
Yeah.
And you go to places and it's so amazing that they actually, in Italy, we were in Milan and we went to some Air Force base that they had with all the hospitals in there and the hospital rooms, everything. It just looked like a residential area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's funny. So that sounds.
Next
time I go
there.
To Montgomery, if you ever,
you should. You should go and take a little tour of Maxwell. And I went there in the summer, and you know, Central Alabama in August is. I actually love it. It's that kind of really close heat and that particular smell, and the cicadas and the
cypress trees, and the live oak trees.
It was
the swamps. Are there swamps there?
Oh, I mean, super. Yeah, it's that whole. I mean, everything's a swamp. I mean, it's so humid. You step outside and you're sort of drenched in sweat.
Yeah.
So the people I write about, the bomber mafia, with this group of young men who they were in Virginia. And they felt that they were misunderstood by the army brass. And they literally said, what is the place we can go in America and be as far away, not just geographically, but intellectually from this orthodoxy we can't stand?
So they were the ones who started to come up with these ideas that bombing selectively would be more humane.
So they decamp to Maxwell Air Force in Montgomery, which is, but in and of itself, is such a kind of strange. Can you imagine being in Montgomery in the 30s and all of a sudden these group of young Air Force pilots just kind of land in the middle of what is the sleepiest, most conservative, kind of most retrograde, you know, town in Alabama. So it's a great story.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So then back to what was your, is this your first book?
The Tipping Point, yes. That was my first book.
This one just puts you on the map. I mean, you were already, one of the best writers that, and you were born in England?
I was,
educated?
Yes. In Canada.
Where?
Outside Toronto, there's a town called Waterloo, which is where the big Canadian Science University is.
And then started to write not only essays, but now this first book was published in what year?
In 2000. I'm betraying my advanced years.
Yes, 58 years old. He has accomplished more than most 58-year-olds ever could hope to accomplish. And what made you choose Tipping Point?
Well, I had, you know—
Describe to our listeners what— because there probably are some, believe it or not, that have not read your book.
Yeah. I moved to New York in 1993. And in 1993, New York was, you'll remember this, was still one of the most dangerous cities in the United States, right? It was famously, I remember going out with my friends, and at the end of the evening, we would pool our money and figure out how everyone was going to get home because it wasn't safe to either walk or take the subway yet.
I don't know where that comes from. I felt so safe in New York.
You did?
I did. I did not feel unsafe until 9/12.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, we had a...
That was the tipping point for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I started to look up.
Yeah.
I never felt like looking up. I was so happy.
You
in
never
New
got
York.
Mugged in New York in the 80s?
I did get mugged once. Uh-huh. It was not a pleasant experience, but I thought that was just a kind of a weird occurrence. I mean, I knew people got mugged, but... You know, you're in the big city.
Yeah.
Yeah. What
did happen? Did you give up your?
I was going to my. You just reminded me of this. I forgot about this. Uh-huh. I was going to my publisher with my only copy of my manuscript for one of my cookbooks. It was probably like Quick Cook or Quick Cook Menus. I can't remember. In a big bag, and I was taking a finished manuscript. And this is pre-computer. You know, we didn't have it on. I think I had a carbon copy at home or something. And I was walking across the street. At that time, they were below 42nd Street on Park Avenue, and I was on a side street. I'm carrying this thing, and some man came up to me and bashed me on my shoulders from the behind. And I dropped my manuscript, and I looked around, what do you want? And he said, I want your money. And I said to people who were standing around me, I said, help me, please. Nobody would help me.
Wait, what time of day is this?
This is like 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And I picked up my bag and I said, you get out of here. And I ran across the street into the building. So I didn't give him any money and nothing. But that was scary. I remember getting hit on the shoulder. My shoulders hurt for a while.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So that was my only mugging.
This was not sufficient to cause you to be scared of New York.
No. No, because that, I mean, I, you know, any city, go to Europe.
Yeah.
You know, go any place, you would get mugged.
I got mugged by someone once, and he said, I have a gun, and he had his hand in his jacket pocket, and it was very clear that it was just his finger, but I wasn't 100% certain that it was his finger. I was maybe 98%, so I thought, well, there's a 2% chance it actually is, right. It could be a small gun. Yeah. So
but
how much
time
do
to
I
think about that?
Yeah, so I thought about this, and then I said, I'm not going to give you my whole wallet, but I will give you the money in my wallet. And he thought that was a good arrangement, and that was the end of it. But no. So to my story, New York in 93 when I got there was statistically at least a very unsafe place. And then within 3 or 4 years, by the late 90s, it was one of the safest cities in the United States. It was this extraordinary transformation. And there was no one who predicted that transformation. To the contrary, if you talked to criminologists in 1993, they would have said that it would be unimaginable that New York would ever be a safe place. They couldn't, or that if it changed at all, it would take decades. But that's not what happened. It turned around in the space of 3 or 4 years. And then if you ask people after it turned around, well, how did that happen? No one had an explanation. Even the savviest criminologists in the country were like, we're baffled as to why this happened. So I was in the middle of this. I was working for the Washington Post, and I left to go to the New Yorker, and I was reflecting on this transformation, and I realized, oh, there must be some way to explain what happened. I should write a book about that. So that was the genesis of the idea of the tipping point, which is that social phenomenon can behave like epidemics. And just, you know, an epidemic is something that mysteriously goes from 0 to 60 in no time, and then just as mysteriously can disappear. Think about the way the flu comes out of nowhere every winter, and then it's gone, right, overnight. So I said, what if crime in a place like New York is following the same logic as contagious disease? And then I thought, well, but what if all kinds of things follow that logic? So what if fashion, you know, trends really follow that? What if they're contagious phenomenon? And so that was what got me thinking. And the tipping point is simply is the term that you use to describe when an epidemic goes from that kind of hidden phase to exploding.
And you wrote so lucidly about that. I mean, it's such an amazing, and tipping point became part of our vernacular.
Bill Clinton used it once, and I was like, I can die happy now.
Yes, of
Bill
course.
Clinton is talking about tipping points.
Yeah. So. Oh, well, everybody has. I can't imagine any public speaker not using tipping point. Is this your favorite book? Do you have a favorite book?
It might be Talking to Strangers. I don't know. I think...
Talking to Strangers. What a great, great book. Tell us about that.
That one was just that I was struck by how many... this is often the way my book ideas come from. You know, I was just struck by how many of the kind of controversies in the news were all about the same thing. This is a couple years ago. They were all versions of, we are confronted with someone and we misinterpret them. So, you know, this was, I was thinking of the book, I was hatching the book when the Bernie Madoff case was at its height. And it was such a classic example of this, that a large group of people think they know Bernie Madoff and they don't. And the people who think they know Bernie Madoff and who are mistaken are not naive. They're intelligent, thoughtful, experienced. They're not.
Well, look how many wealthy, intelligent,
exactly,
successful people invested with him.
Exactly. So it's
how were they taken in by him?
So this is what was interesting. Because normally when we see a scam artist, we say, oh, a scam artist is someone who takes advantage of the vulnerable, of people who don't know anything, are easily fooled, they're old, they're badly educated. You know, we come up with all kinds of reasons why they were susceptible to being taken in that way. None of those arguments work with Bernie Madoff. He fooled the creme de la creme.
He did.
And so that makes him really interesting, right? And then I thought, oh, there's tons of other examples of this. You know, in the book I write about the case of Jerry Sandusky, the football coach at Penn State, who was a pedophile. Oh, yeah. And he, you know, the people who were taken in by him, the president of the university was fooled by him. The Joe Paterno, one of the great football coaches of our day, was fooled by him. These were not people who were, there was an argument made that I strenuously disagree with, that said that those people, Joe Paterno and the president, Graham
Spener, looked the other way.
Were complicit in, they were not complicit.
Yeah.
The idea that a president of the university would look the other way if he thought there was a pedophile on the staff of his school is nonsense. They were fooled by him in the same way that people were fooled by Bernie Madoff. And the same way that all of us, if we are honest about ourselves, we realize that we are also, on occasion, excessively trusting. And so what I wanted to discover in
all
this book
of us,
is,
you really think that you can put us all in the same bucket?
Human beings. So this is the kind of core argument of the book, which is this idea by this guy named Tim Levine, a brilliant researcher in Birmingham, Alabama. His argument is that we are by nature trusting as human beings, which is why we have achieved what we've achieved, right? We would never have been able to build a modern society, to form companies, to innovate, to collaborate, to do anything of value unless we trusted each other. But the cost of that implicit trust that we have for one another is that we will occasionally be deceived. On occasion, we are a little too willing to extend the benefit of the doubt to people. And that means that Madoff can come along every now and again and make off with our money. Now, the good news, though, is that there are vanishingly few Bernie Madoffs in the world. But what Tim would say is that that's the price we pay for everything else that's good about the world. I mean, if you think about, just think about your
people,
own.
The few people that we have to put up with in the world.
Think about your own career. You have gone from one thing to the next where you have built these organizations, companies, communities, all of these things, these collaborative things you've done over the course, everything that you've done has been based on trust, right? You also extend that benefit of the doubt to others, right? That's what I said. The collaborative nature of so many of the things that you have done are evidence that you, the people who give trust are rewarded with trust. That's a kind of a fundamental principle of
but every now and then a bad egg
and
rolls
we have to
into the picture.
We can't let them ruin it for the rest of us. We have to kind of, you have to say, all right, Madoff took me, but that doesn't mean that I have to assume that everyone who I deal with is trying to rip me off. That is not the right way to live your life, right?
I wanted to get back to Tipping Point just for one second. Did you ever, when you were writing this book, envision a pandemic like COVID-19?
Well, oddly, yes, I did. Because when I was at the Washington Post, before I wrote Tipping Point, one of the jobs I had was that I was, I covered the AIDS epidemic for the Post. We had a full-time reporter covering that. And I was covering it at one of the worst stretches, so before we had any kind of effective treatment. And in that period of my life, had many long conversations with epidemiologists and virologists. I knew Tony Fauci back in the day, back when Tony I called him Tony, an extraordinary human being who saw America through two, devastating epidemics. But if you spend any time at all with virologists, you absolutely entertain the notion that there's going to be a big one day. I mean, that's what they spend their lives worrying about that and trying to protect us against that eventuality. So I would go down to the CDC in Atlanta and they would talk about, there was a moment when back in the 80s when we were fearful about how much damage AIDS whether HIV could spread far and wide, as opposed to being confined to particular subgroups. When it became clear that HIV was not nearly as contagious as we thought it was, then the question immediately arose, well, what would a truly contagious virus look like? It looked a lot like COVID-19, by the way.
And would you see in the near future for that? Are you going to write another book about that or not?
No, I doubt. My good friend Michael Spector, who was also covered HIV with me at the Washington Post, he's doing a book right now on vaccines. And so there are other better people writing about this. But what he would tell you is that although it is absolutely the case that we're going to get hit with something probably a lot even scarier than COVID-19, our ability to respond to those things effectively and quickly is so much better than it was 5 years ago. I mean, so it's an arms race, and we might be winning the arms race right now.
So what about, you must have thought about Ukraine, Russia. What do you think?
Well, there's a thing that I follow. There's something called Military Logistics Twitter, which is a group of these military people, ex-army guys mostly, on Twitter, who are obsessed with logistics. All they care about is, like, how do you supply an army? Do you they have long Twitter threads on, they examine a picture of a tire from a Russian armored car, and they'll tell you on the basis of what the tire looks like, what's wrong with the Russian army. Those guys. And from the beginning, they have been remarkably optimistic about Ukraine's chances, even back in March, based on the fact that they just think that the Russians, although they have a large army, they're just seriously incompetent in war making. And that's really been, and the Ukrainians, by contrast, are in the eyes of these people who I follow. This is, by the way, the greatest thing about Twitter, is that you can locate a community of people who know insane amounts about a very specific thing, and you can follow them. You can get, it's as if I'm talking to these guys every day. You know, me and hundreds of thousands of people around the world get access to the genius of these people. So they've been pointing out that...
Well, are the Russians reading it?
Oh, of course. Yeah. But it's not.
Are they understanding that they're ill-prepared?
It's a little late in the day to fix things when you're in the middle of a war.
And nobody's providing arms for, or maybe somebody is helping them with more armaments.
Yeah, they're not being supplied with the sort of state-of-the-art equipment the way the Ukrainians are.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them.
Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's the focus of your next book?
I'm writing a book about Tom Bradley. Remember the mayor of Los Angeles?
Oh, yes.
First African-American mayor of Los Angeles. And it's a lot of it. It's turning into a lot about what does it mean to be, first of all, what was Los Angeles like in the 40s and 50s? And in particular, what does it mean to be Black in Los Angeles in the 40s and 50s? So I'm very, very focused on his early, long before he gets to be mayor, I'm very focused on his early days. And it's been—
Where did he grow up? What section?
He grew up just off Central Avenue. So, you know, the Black community in those years was concentrated south of downtown on either side of, the term South Central refers to the neighborhoods on either side of Central Avenue. It's been absolutely fascinating. I've been reading about Jackie Robinson because Jackie Robinson is, a Black Angeleno of that era, grew up in Pasadena, goes to UCLA, is friends with Tom Bradley. They went to college together.
Amazing.
So there's a world of all of these people that knew each other, that interacted, and that were all dealing with the same issues in LA in those years. And I've been listening to all this kind of jazz from LA, because that's the 40s and 50s, of course, is the time when that kind of music was...
Sounds like a good movie, too.
Oh, I think it would be an amazing... Oh. It would be an amazing audiobook, because there's so much incredible tape of that era and of all these incredible...
Speeches and the voices.
This is before both of our time, but Jack Benny had a radio show in the...
We sat at our kitchen table in 86 Elm Place in Nutley and listened to Jack
Benny. Did you really?
We did. We were allowed to listen to Jack Benny, to The Shadow, to Lone Ranger, Dagwood. I mean, there were certain
programs. Do you remember Rochester?
Of course. Rochester was his aide-de-camp, you know?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay. His sidekick.
Jack Benny is, there's people who don't know, Jack Benny is... One of the great American comedians.
One of the very great.
Yeah, he's very up great. There with, you know, that generation,
Sid
George
Caesar.
Burns.
Sid Caesar. Sid Caesar?
Yes, that whole. And he had he had this famous radio show, and he had a sidekick on the radio show. It was a Black actor called Eddie Anderson, who played Jack Benny's butler. But he was this kind of, he wasn't a subservient, you know.
He was outrageous.
He was outrageous. Eddie Anderson, who played Rochester, was his informal title was the mayor of Central Avenue. So he's living in that part of Los Angeles where all these people were, Tom Bradley, Jackie Robinson, Eddie Anderson. And Eddie Anderson is the kind of guy you would go to if you were Black in LA in the 40s and you had a problem, you'd go to Eddie Anderson. He lived, had a magnificent house not far from Central Avenue, and he had a He must have
driven around in a fancy car.
Oh my God, he had racehorses, a famous racehorse called Burnt Cork, which was his way of thumbing his nose at, because Burnt Cork was what people used
to blacken
their faces. The minced the whole kind of, and he his way of kind of giving the finger to that racist tradition.
Burnt Cork was
to call his racehorse Burnt Cork. I mean, he had a sense of humor about even that. But that's the world I'm embedded in right now.
You have to make a movie.
Oh, it would be
this book. What's it called?
I haven't come up with a title yet for the book, but and it changes. I'm only in mid book, so it's changing all the time. But I'm just interested in this cast of characters and what influence they had on the young Tom Bradley, because he's a remarkable. Did you ever meet him? A remarkable man who's been forgotten. You know, I always say everyone else gets an airport named after them. The LAX should be Tom Bradley Airport. All they named after him was the International Terminal. It's such a diss. The man was mayor of Los Angeles for 20 years. He is the father of modern LA. He revived downtown LA. He's the first African-American to be the mayor of a major American city where African-Americans were not the majority. He's an incredible figure in 20th century American politics, and he's been hidden away and forgotten, I think unjustly, in Los Angeles.
Okay, well, that I cannot wait for the new book, and I'm going to make sure it's a movie. I have a part for Snoop Dogg in that movie. I want to know about Pushkin, and you're making all kinds of wonderful podcasts with this company, and you partnered with
one of my oldest friends, Jacob Weisberg, who I met in Washington, D.C. in 1985, when he was 19. And he rented a room from me, a windowless, un-air-conditioned room from me in the Washington, D.C. summer. So he was in retrospect, it was a torturous experience for him. But he and I, about 4 years ago, 3 years ago now, decided to get together and start a little audio company, which we call Pushkin. And it's to make my podcast after the novelist. Actually, sort of. I had a dog called Pushkin, who was named after the Russian poet. So it's the Russian poet by one step removed.
Okay, this, through a dog.
My first dog, a delightful lab. He was actually a mutt. But so we started this company, and we do my podcast, Revisionist History. We make audiobooks. We do a bunch of other podcasts, The Happiness Lab, Aloy Santos, which has been a big success for us, and Michael Lewis's podcast, Against the Rules, and a bunch of Broken Record, this music podcast that we do. And we do audiobooks. For example, we did something called Miracle and Wonder. I went, actually, he lived not far from here, he no longer does, but with my friend Bruce, we did an audiobook with Paul Simon called Miracle and Wonder. And we sat down with him for 40 hours. I would drive from Hudson to New Canaan, to his house.
He just sold his house to Richard Gere.
He sold his house to Richard Gere?
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Richard bought it.
It's a lovely house. This is in the middle of the pandemic. I would go there. I must have gone there 7 or 8 times. And Paul, who's such a genius, we would meet in his studio. And he would just talk and play. And we would ask him questions. And we used those tapes and created this audiobook called Miracle and Wonder, which is one of the best things I've ever been associated with. And
so you're designing books that are not really printed books, but they're audio because they can incorporate the music, they can incorporate speech.
Yeah.
What a great idea.
Why would you read about Paul Simon when you can listen to him? Because, the fun part is when he'd be talking about something and he'd pick up his guitar. I used to always say, I would say to Bruce, who I did the book with, I was like, Paul has to have his guitar in his hands because, of course, he's a musician. He thinks with a guitar in his hands, right? And he would be talking and he'd say, and then I thought of this, and he would play something. It was just so magical to have this genius in front of you recreating some moment of inspiration.
Audio, but it could have also been a documentary.
It could have been, but it would have been, here's my issue with documentaries. There's so much more work involved with documentary that it takes you out of the moment. I mean, what was fun about us visiting with Paul is it was really just his engineer, Bruce, me, and Paul. There were no cameramen. There were no We weren't stopping every 15 minutes to dab someone's forehead and change the tape and adjust the lighting.
No, I agree. It sounds like such a great idea.
It was just a kind of, it was so relaxing and fun.
So you get a different perspective of Paul Simon through an audio book or an audio podcast.
You do see something closer, I think. You give up something, you don't get to see him.
Yeah.
But you gain something, which is you gain a kind of intimacy because we're all so relaxed and in the moment.
But has he done a documentary?
He is doing a documentary, actually. That's, I think, going to come out this year. Yeah. So there's books about Paul.
Right.
You can get everything you want at this point. Yeah. But
no, and he deserves all kinds of coverage, don't you think?
I love him so much. Yeah. I think I truly think he is. He is the great 20th century American songwriter. I don't think anyone else is on his level.
The lyrics.
Amazing.
Yeah, I grew up with him, stomping around the house, listening to Paul Simon and Garfunkel.
It's amazing that he's been a part of your entire life.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, how many artists can you say of that they are relevant to you over decades and decades?
Elvis.
Yeah, although Elvis's window is so much shorter.
So small, but so powerful. I mean, I still, and Carole King.
Oh, yeah.
She was very important to me.
I have always wanted to interview Carole King.
She's fantastic. You should do her.
Her.
I know her.
Oh, my goodness. I would love that.
You
so
should
much.
Do that.
I just think that.
Yeah. And she has that raspy, fabulous voice, and she's just an incredible person.
So you know that she tutored Paul Simon in math when they were kids in Queens.
I didn't know that, but
they go way, 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 way back. Wow. They were doing things together as teenagers. They had some part-time job.
In her Broadway play? I don't remember that.
I don't think so. But they knew each other from the neighborhood. It's hilarious to think of all these people in the same, little world back then.
I once had dinner with Bono and Carole King together in Ireland, in Dublin. What a great night that was. And I didn't even know. I mean, I'm so naive. I was sitting there with these people and, how you think afterward, oh, my God, that's a moment. And before everybody's holding up their phones and taking pictures of everybody.
But
what fun that was. But your work is so interesting. And you have time to do the podcasts, which are so valuable to so many of us who spend time on a treadmill, riding a bike around the countryside, listening to podcasts. Podcasts, I think, are turning into something very valuable for the human race, just because you do get to know subjects more intimately than you would just reading. And sometimes you can't read. You can't read while you're doing something else, but you can listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
And now with the new little earbuds, they promise it doesn't hurt your eardrums. You know, they're promising it. Do you believe that?
Kind of. I mean, I would be, acting against my own interest if I discourage people from putting them in. Right. So
no. I just read a big report that they're not. They are totally harmless to the hearing of our youth.
Yeah. Well, the issue is the volume.
Yeah.
Not the earbud itself. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll make note of that for the grandchildren who you want to be able to talk to when they get old. So. Well, it's been so much fun talking to you. We could go on forever, but I think we've covered a lot of territory.
Thank you, Martha. Yeah.
And I cannot wait for your newest book.
Yeah.
And I want everybody to know that the latest book, The Bomber Mafia, A Dream, A Temptation, and The Longest Night of the Second World War, is in bookstores right now and, of course, online. You can listen to Malcolm's podcast, Revisionist History and Broken Record, wherever you get your podcasts. And, of course, you can keep up with Malcolm by following him on Twitter. Is your Twitter as interesting as that bunch of strategists and logistic guys?
Oh, no, not nearly as interesting. But occasionally I have something nice to say.
I'm sure more than occasionally. And the handle is @GladwellMalcolm. It has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today, and I really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much
for coming all the way from Hudson.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. Martha, you've got one of the great collections of
cookbooks
that I've ever seen.
Oh, it's edited too. I have thousands more, but I keep editing because there's so many cookbooks.
Yeah. How many of these do you use?
Well, I know where they are. I know they're all here. and we've used them over the years. We've created 30,000 recipes now. There are 35,000.
Oh wow!
So this is reference.
Yeah,
these are reference.
If you had to take one with you.
One book.
You're going to Desert Island. You could take.
Oh, really? The craziest thing is Joy of Cooking.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. Yeah,
there's my various editions of Joy of Cooking. See?
Yeah.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.